again, continue.
A little bit with the seven planets we're doing last week.
You understand me properly.
You can really get down to the basis of depth psychology. So we'll have to start again with that horrible thing, the circle. Outside here, the undefined, whatever it is such that it can and does produce finites. And then necessarily, it must return to itself ultimately. This can be said to be a diagram of any finite being whatever. They're all generated in exactly the same way. So that whether we're talking about the whole universe, the sidereal system, the solar system, the earth as a being, an individual, the seed of a plant, of an animal, of a man, they're all generated in exactly the same way. We said when the incoming force is considered in isolation, that force is called Saturn. Now there's a very peculiar equation here that we have to understand if we're going to understand the depth of religious propositions. Saturn is the urn of being, Sat. Sat is the being. Our word sit, Sat, is the same root. Because sitting or making a seat is primarily rotating. So the urn of Sat is the first impulse. But this is the creator. And therefore we can equate Saturn with God the Father. This is very, very important because the same impulse exactly is called the devil. Because it divides. The devil is the divider. And what is being divided is the outer from the inner essence. So when we consider this as a dividing wheel, it is correct to call it a devilish wheel. So when the Bible says that the whole world lies in the grip of the devil, it is referring to the world as a finite system. And nevertheless, if we look at the old spelling in the 17th century used by Hobbes in his work Leviathan, you find it spelled devil like an Irishman says it. Really, this is the old form, div, which is the deal, God, of the Latins, and el, which is the working aspect of the power. It means the dividing God, the God of divisions. This el, or the Hebrew form of it, I'm going to write it that way. This is the letter translated E, although it's really A. And that is the L. You can see the top part of it is our L here. So this means first worker. This means division. And being division, it is the cause, read Hebraica, of videre, the root of to see. If there is no finiting, there is nothing to see. So we have to make a finite being in order to make seeing possible. Remove finity and there is only absolute, with no possibility of seeing at all. This is called abyss up here, and this inside here is called bis. Now, bis simply means woven. Abyss means not woven. The Greek root from which this comes, bisos, is a kind of cloth. So the abyss is the unwoven, and the bis is the woven. So abyss is already a negation of the weaving process of power. And when the power comes in and weaves, then it produces a universe. Carlyle borrows this idea in Sartre of Sartre's, the tailor patch, where he imagines God as a tailor making clothes with his power and clothing himself, weaving his own power. The Indian version of it is a spider spinning out of its own body a web. It makes inside itself its internal secretions a fluid. It then extrudes that fluid and it becomes a thread. And with that thread it makes a web. And then the spider, having made a web, is confined to the web that it's made. So it then lives in it, because the web is then its means of livelihood. In the same way, the saturnine impression is the cause of this weaving process. And the outfling from it is the counterstroke to the saturnine impression, which is called, funnily enough, Jupiter. Now Saturn is Chronos, time, the time generator. And the attempt to get out of the time into eternity is called Jupiter. But Jupiter means God the Father, the Deo Pater. And God the Father, we've just said, is the same as the force going in. Because when the force is coming in and creating or arcing, it brings being into existence, makes the sixfold wheel out of it, and when it's brought it into being, it immediately feels restrained by its own activities, like a spider does when it's made a web. And after a time, the web gets mucky and full of old dead bodies and flies sucked dry, and it feels it should go away and make another web elsewhere. The reconception of this will to create, the desire to go out again, is like the spider leaving its web. The same kind of thing in the Greek mythology appears as Ariadne giving a thread to a hero who's going in to kill the Minotaur in the labyrinth. The same weaving of forces. This is a diagram of the palace at Knossos where the Minotaur is kept in the labyrinth. And he's given a thread so that when he goes inside, he will be able to come back by means of the thread. He's been given an escape. A Minotaur is said to be a bull-headed man. And the bull means the earth. It's the fixed sign of the earth signs. And Taurus means bull, Mino means counter. So, as it's an earth sign, it means to come in, to turn around, to make counting, to be caught in the counting process. All of which is to be devoured by the Minotaur. And Theseus must kill this Minotaur in order to escape and cause the Minotaur no more to eat up virgins every year. The virgins it eats every year are the lights that appear in the mind, which it devours. You say a governing concept is devoured by this application energy in the material field.
Not just energy, not virgin energy that has not been formed. It's definitely a form.
Oh, no, it's a special kind. You have to create the virgin here with the light body of the whole process. Essentially, this virgin is wisdom. And this wisdom is all the formal actualities contained in this sphere. It is a dome, and inside it is the whiz, the Yoshua, or saving energy. And the whole process of the Saviour, the Yahushua, and the dome contained in it, together considered, is wisdom. And that is virgin, so called, because it is said to be not a geritrix. It does not itself make anything. But when we look at it, or when a will contemplates it, the will is provoked by looking at it to do something with it, and then generates. But itself is called virgin because it doesn't of itself generate. Later on we'll come to consider just how that same virgin wisdom, which is in Adam prior to the separation of Eve, is actually Eve, and how the Eve form has to cover the fiery energy of the male, which then represents the matrix, which is made of water, which is contra fire, where the man equals fire and the woman equals water. And the fire would utterly consume itself if it were not damped in its armour by the softness of the feminine water which this wisdom represents. You know that if you can't see how to do something, as a male, when you're working on a problem, you can get very, very annoyed and worked up. If you've got a car with a dead carburetor, and you clean it out and it still doesn't go, so you pump the tyres up and so on, and it still doesn't go, you find you're getting overheated. What you really want is light. See, there must be light. Now, what is really the matter with it? If you don't get that light, you can be very, very annoyed, and you can't even digest your dinner properly. This kind of internal vexation in the will to solve the problem, which is the male will, the will to solve the problem formally, if defeated, overheats itself, because it concentrates very hard and drives itself to find the solution. Every solution is a liquid. The solution, when it comes, is like a beautiful lady called Wisdom, who immediately mollifies the fiery nervous energies that have been chasing about in the body. Suddenly a smile comes over him. He's found it. The lady of his dreams. It wasn't the carburetor at all. There was no petrol in. And so on. Whatever it is, to him at that moment, it's like a very, very beautiful lady who comes in and mollifies his angry self. And for this reason, it is said that when Adam was made and found desiring the external world instead of the internal one, he was separated and the eternal wisdom was put into the woman, but as passive. Then he desired to take it and it refused, saying, "No, I am listening to God outside here." Thereupon the young man, the young Adam, the natural man in Adam, seized hold of this woman and tried to force her to his will. And she turned to God and complained about his naughtiness. And God said, "It's too late now, because he cannot be saved unless you will water him a bit. You must mollify him, because now his desire is so terrible, he'll be utterly consumed. And I have created him for a special job of ruling on earth, and therefore you must give in to him." And therefore it says in Genesis, "And the desire of the woman shall be to the man," is a command by God. Because otherwise the man would burn himself up. Now there's a great secret hidden in this.
Not that much, that.
If you meditate on what it means, every being is hermaphroditic. Inside himself he has a terrible fiery drive, and the fire is the ground of his logic. He works towards a formal solution. And if he doesn't get the solution, he's going to be very annoyed forever. But there is something in him that already knows that which he's trying to find out, which is why he beats his head and says, "Why didn't I think of this before?" He drives himself very hard while he's awake and sets the problem. When he's exhausted with his individual effort to solve it and has failed in his exhaustion, or maybe while he's asleep, then the whole thing goes into equilibrium and the solution is found on awaking. This is given to him. As an individual, he hasn't been able to work it out. But when he lets go, then the solution is already there. In other words, really, he was bathed in this sphere of wisdom, and his own individual efforts to solve it defeated him. This is why the egotistic effort to solve a problem always defeats itself. And the same thing that goes in the relation between the idea in a man and the will exists between a man and a woman, and between the sun and the moon, and so on. Now we're going to look at the other forms in here. The continuous whizzing in and out, continuously all the way round, of the Saturn and Jupiter forces are called Mercury. This Mercury mixes the whole process. So that we have then an internal compressive force going in so far that it hurts itself, desiring to escape. The whole creation groaneth and travaileth to be delivered from vanity. Let's get out. You can only get that conception to go out when it has gone in and failed. So it doesn't really like freedom until bondage has restricted it. and lets us rub out all this circle, rub it all out, and conceive the paper again, there is no value whatever in non-manifestation, and therefore there is no appreciation of freedom. But by setting up a wheel and then squeezing oneself very hard within it, then comes an appreciation of freedom. Now, every individual who comes into the world is first made into a cell, and then that cell is treated by the addition of energies from food, from the mother, and develops itself internally, and all the time it is apparently increasing in power until it reaches a certain level where it discovers that it cannot fulfill itself, and then it begins to look beyond itself for the source of freedom. So the whole concept of freedom depends on bondage. So that Jupiter is said to be the second form alchemically. Although it's God the Father, it isn't mentioned first. It is mentioned second. The first one is the Saturnine one, coming to exist as an individual. And the second one is the awareness of freedom as lost. If you don't lose it, you can't find it. This is why one of the alchemists says, a beautiful jewel is in the forehead of the toad. The toad is the German toad, death. This wheel is death. And the jewel that's in it is right in the center where the pain is greatest. At that point is where you conceive that freedom is not bad after all. And so you fly out. So it's only when you're very, very near death that you really appreciate freedom. And people are not really concerned with freedom until they are incarcerated. People thrown into a concentration camp, that's a concentration camp, think quite a lot about freedom, whereas people inside an office, where they believe they are free to go out and post a letter and come back and so on, they're not so much concerned with the concept of freedom, because it isn't made imperative for them to get it. So a good government tries to restrain people so subtly that they don't know that they're restrained, in the same way that it taxes them indirectly, so they don't know they're taxed. Everything has to be done on the curb, to curb people, otherwise they will immediately desire freedom. So if you go up to a man in the street, if you're strong enough, grab hold of him and pin his arms to his side and wrap your legs around his and don't let him move, he'd immediately feel restrained and feel it necessary to become a free man. Whereas if you put a pamphlet in his hand advertising something he thinks he wants, he'll be curved into bondage, and he will believe that he's doing freely what he wants, although he has not created the want. And until we can create wants and uncreate wants, we're not really free. And in order to do this, we must become prodigal. Now, this prodigality is the same thing as the indrive into manifestation. So prodigality is Saturnine. It is a drive into material existence. And when we've driven into the very, very limit of it, to the greatest degree of physical restraint, then we say, I will arise and go to my Father, go back to the free. But the whole process is simply a spin which doesn't go back. It doesn't become anti-clockwise. It just keeps going out in the same way. So there's no real opposition between the Saturnine and the Jupiterian forces. So if they're shown as opposites, the opposition is unreal. It is in fact a simple process of a rotation towards the centre and away from the centre without in any sense contradicting itself. There's no internal contradiction between contraction and expansion. If we put the whole mesh of the other wheels on here, the six around this one, and so on, we see how complicated it will become. If we keep it very simple like this, we can analyse it and see what's going to happen. Imagine this big sphere is like the egg, which is fluid internally. If energy doesn't come in, Saturnine compress energy from the mother, it cannot begin to divide itself. So it would be very, very passive, that egg, just suspended and doing nothing. But if we put the energy inside it, and there is the whole sphere of the universe with its formal contour vibrating, then the energy is disposed according to the vibrations present in the body of the mother at that time. Now the body of the mother is on the earth, and the earth is somewhere in the solar system, and the solar system is somewhere in the sidereal system. So we say that the forces of the macrocosmos are qualifying all the time in the egg of a child. The reason we reckon astrologically from the birth of a child is because it is the impact of the air that seals the sidereal heritage. The first breath the child gets gives a special shock to the whole sidereal vibration inside the fluids of that child. That's why we reckon it from the moment of the extrusion. Some people say we should reckon it from the moment of conception. Conception gives a certain amount of influence, but the operative thing for sealing the character is the first breath. Now, as it's pressing in here, it's obvious the greatest compression is right at the centre, where all the forces are driving in and becoming very dense. As they are going round, they are, because it is a substance, rubbing. There is friction, there is stress and strain there. That friction generates heat. We're then going to put the sign of Mars just outside here to represent the heat. So there's a zone of heat here. And the reconception to get out of this here, to escape, and the loss of centripetal force here pressing on the center causes a disintegration round here into bits, and Mercury fallen is then represented very small here as the breaking wheel. You know how a flying wheel, if you make it go too fast, will fly to bits. It is the speed that breaks it. So right near the center we have a saturnine band, very, very strong, called the band of death. The heat generated by it, Mercury, which is guaranteeing the continuous spin round it, and these three things together are called the three nails of the cross. The harsh saturnine, the martial, fiery, and the bitterness of the breaking wheel. Now, the existentialists, derived largely from Kierkegaard, say that the universe is built on Sorge and angst, fear, anxiety. Now, the center of every being is nothing else except a turning, an attempt to come to be by compressing, and in the flying round the compression to escape the pain is the generation of the heat, and in the heat is the intolerableness, and in that intolerableness is the breaking, and it is this breaking that splits the egg and causes the process of mitosis. You can actually smell the processes very easily if you get an ordinary chrysalis and smell it in its various stages as it goes from the first time the caterpillar weaves itself its little cocoon, and then smell it. It's alive, and its chemistry is going to change, and it's going to show you exactly how any being comes to be on the nose. Now, the nose is your oldest discriminator. It's still the public analyst's best friend. Take the nose off him and he loses his job. You will smell in the center of it, that is in the beginning of this compression, when it's going to change itself from a caterpillar into a butterfly, a harsh, sour bitterness. And as it's going through its various phases, you'll smell what you would call a hot, peppery smell. And you'll find, if you've got several of these and watch the outer changes of them,
and repeatedly smell them, because you can see the form will change on the outside. You'll see certain colour changes, formal changes, and changes of smell, which will tell you just what is operative at any given moment. Now, the end of all nature, the purpose and aim of all nature, is called the Barmherzigkeit, the warm-heartedness. It is the compassion or affection for the whole process of creation. But we cannot get it unless we drive so hard into the center and rotate so hard that we make heat, and the heat becomes so intense that it incandesces the bits, producing a flash of light right through the lot. Now, the human soul is made in a threefold essence. That is to say, it's made with a saturnine compass, it's rooted in fire, and it breaks formally in bitterness. This means that every being that exists has to go through these phases of existence. If it isn't driven very, very hard, it cannot rub itself to the point where it incandesces. It cannot strike a light. When the light shines through it, the light flashing out here illuminates the whole sphere of being and mollifies the whole process. So that what previously was a very, very harsh concentration and a grip like death, with the light shining back into it, allows this very compacted rotation here to spread out. The whole process then becomes a very joyful wheel. And then, instead of turning and grinding itself, quite suddenly it integrates and it stands instead of rotating. Now, prior to the standing, it is rotating and is compressing on the center very, very hard with the three nails in it, Saturn, Mars, and Mercury. Now, we cannot get Mercury unless there is Jupiter, because Jupiter is that flight from the center. But if that flight from the center were too big, there would not be sufficient contraction. But if there's just enough attempt to get away, immediately stopped by the Saturn, then Mercury is present, but it's very, very dark. Now, this stage of being is called hell, where a person is gripping, holding an idea, being possessive, and is desiring as hard as he can, and at the same time his mercurial intellectual process is plotting very, very quickly how to secure Saturn, the object of his desire, Mars. While it is doing that, that is the state called hell. And this is the horrible state where the three nails are in a being: possessiveness, desire, and sharp, cunning brain devising its methods, all in the darkness of egotism. This is hell. And it is solemnly promised in the non-emasculated version of the New Testament that any person who doesn't strike this big light, if he dies, he's going to be stuck eternally in that. That is, if he doesn't get this macrocosmic light, he's going to be eternally in hell. His psychic state will be one in which he is grabby, full of desire, and a very sharp mind, but dark and circumscribed, and unable to see how to get, really, what he wanted. The Barmherzigkeit, the big, warm-hearted relation with the whole macrocosmos. Now, that is the state called hell. It is an eternal state, and it's a simple either-or. Either you get stuck in that state, pure, egotistic, covetous, desiring machinations of the mercurial brain, or you manage to strike a light and suddenly see the necessity for letting go to give yourself more room, which allows the introduction of the light back into this, and the generation by the light in the whole water of the egg of oil. Now, there is no oil in that water before the light is struck. The water is acid, sharp. Do you smell that chrysalis at a certain stage? Before it has won its battle, before it's just turned into butterfly, you smell it? It's very harsh and sour and astringent. And then, when the light is struck through it and shines back, then there appears in the liquid an oil. Now that oil, in beings, in living beings, is a product of love. Love is an emotion. If you get it, you increase the oil content in your body. The synovial fluid in your joints will increase if you have that tolerance. There was a lady in the Bible who was found taken in adultery. And Christ said about her, she just loved too much, that one. There was a lot of oil in her. That was her only sin. The opposite thing is to have no oil. When the fluid in the joints, which is a necessary lubricant, is compressed, which it is by certain fears, which are saturnine, covetous, desirous, and continuously spinning round to plot how to get, it decreases the oil content in the body, and then you get joint troubles. Arthritis and so on come out of this process. Lack of love, which is an emotion which generates the oil in the fluids in the body. So if you took out of the body all the love, you would immediately reduce the person to a hell. The state in an arthritic joint, when somebody tries to move it, it feels hot and prickly, and if you smell the joint, you will smell this process going on inside. There's a compression, the saturnine. There's a breaking of that crystalline thing, which makes a bitter prickle. And there is a heat from the activity going on. If the person grips very, very hard, they can make themselves solid and knobbly. And the joints will start to look spherical. Because round every one of your joints, if you have if a finger will bend there, it actually means there's a vortex of energy in the field. You've got a bone in your finger like that, and another one like this. The fact that the bone there has a gap between it demonstrates to you that there is a field down there. Otherwise, if there weren't, the bone would be continuous. If you look at the ends of those bones very carefully, you'll see that they are spinning round. If you put the bones under a microscope, you can see the stress and strain lines in them to show you what kind of forces are actually present on the precipitation of the bones. If you take an X-ray photograph through, say, the head of the femur or something like that, you'll see the kind of forces that are spinning and modelling that material form. So here we have the generative process which produces all our primary psychological levels. Here is the grab, the individual grab, which is trying to hold on to itself first and then to anything that seems to enhance its own value. And then the spinning round generates terrific heat. And this heat is the desire life, seeking to rise up and bring more and more and more and involve all the being in this saturnine process. And the Mercury, the fact that it rotates, shows that there's a little bit of Jupiter, an attempt to get away from it. But the saturnine compass is so great it won't let the Jupiter motion move far away from the centre. So the whole process is a dark wheel. That dark wheel is called turba. Lovely, horrible word. You can see that it means turning house. This is now a dark house. This is called the dark chamber of death. This is the same death that Paul says, "Oh, death, where is thy sting?" When the new birth, the birth back into the freedom concept, and the tolerance, the allowance, tolerance in the engineer sense, the allowance that the individual cannot save himself and must allow this macrocosmic light to infiltrate. Now he can't do it as an individual until he's been prodigal. First of all, he must try to do it on his own, because he must be convinced. He must be convinced by his own experience that if he tries to do it, he must fail. And only when he's convinced, in the conviction is the victory. Because on being convinced, he suddenly says, well, why bother trying to do it that way? He allows the space, he rubs himself, and suddenly there's a crack. His concept breaks, and the light shines through, and it meets the absolute light coming in, which he never saw before, from which was absolutely present, penetrating the whole process. This is called the new birth. The whole process is the regeneration of man. When St. Paul says we are first a physical body and afterwards a spiritual body, he's talking about this physical fact, that up to a certain level in the developing egg into child, there is no soul there. But the soul is when these three processes begin to spin round. Now, the air comes out of the liquid at a certain point, vaporizes, and that air, working back into it, alters the whole relation. And it's because of this, at each level, there are a series of shocks. There's the initial shock on freedom of the grab. There's then the attempt to escape the Jupiter, which is a shock on the grab itself. It feels as if about to escape. It re-grabs at it. This produces the Mercury, the sudden spin. And the mind, the whole of this can be considered as cosmic mind, as well as an individual human being. When the mind suddenly spins round to try to resolve the opposition between the egotism and the non-egotism. It is this spinning round that produces the mind's furnishings. The same spinning round carried out in the regenerated man is the Mercury, which is the Messiah. But inside, prior to the light shining through it, that same Mercury is the devil, the twin brother of Christ. So the very same rotating process which keeps this dark hell in being, where it's generated the light, the prodigal son, gone to his term and picking it in the centre, suddenly conceives the desire to go out. Then space is allowed, and the whole being then feels comfortable. And that warm-heartedness flowing through the whole thing is the aim, end, or purpose of nature in every being. And if it doesn't attain that, it will strive to get it. So it is said the whole of nature groans to be delivered from vanity. Everything inside here is continuously breaking, falling to bits, disintegrating. A human mind, if we consider that to be a diagram of an individual human mind, if it is covetous, hanging on to an idea, doesn't matter what the idea is, it can be a so-called good idea religiously, or a bad idea, if it hangs on to it and desires to propagate it very hard, then the mercurial spin will start in it, and machinations, the machinery of the mind, will operate. It will become a very dark, devilish, cunning being, like a Jehovah's Witness. And it will produce all sorts of spurious biblical quotations, and even produce its own version of the Bible, if necessary. And all of this is the natural product of the primary covetousness producing in the centre a terrible pain, the pain giving rise to the desire for freedom, the freedom giving rise to the sense of loss in the Saturnine compass, causing the Saturn to grab more fiercely, and that inducing a more rapid rotation, that producing the heat, and that heat pushed to each term, producing a crack, exactly the same as the lightning in the sky, which flashes through the whole process, comes back and illuminates the being, and it then understands what it is. The whole process, this is called heaven up here, where everything is very, very charming and joyous. And there is heaven in us now, at a certain level of frequency. There is also hell. Wherever we allow ourselves to believe in ourselves as finite egoic beings, valid in our own rights, with our own desires and our own cleverness, and our own limit. That appears to be the limit of the body. But this is the field. When we become field consciousness, and we know that the field of another being is, he has a physical body of another one, and here's the field of the other one. When we know that these fields are shared, and we know absolutely that it's an absolute field, shared by everyone, that wisdom is no individual's property and must be shared, at that point, when we realize it, we become heaven consciousness. Now, we said on one occasion that paradise means beyond division. Paradise means beyond duality. When we become field conscious, we know that there is no division, really. There are merely functions with centers. And the function has created the center, and the compression in the center has created the individuality, the egoic awareness. But it's only a function in a field which is absolutely shared. If we become aware of this, then we find already that the field is populated with beings. This is a level that is loosely termed in various ways by different people. The level of the elementals, Paracelsus, the level of the astrals and theosophists and so on. This is the heaven world, where everything is very, very charming. There, everything flows beautifully, there's plenty of space. It's warm, it isn't cold. Coldness comes from the compression. And the heat from the compressed center shines out all the time and makes it very pleasant. If you go near to yourself as an individual, you immediately start producing hell. That is, the moment you actually define yourself as a separate individual, you make a concept, you start restraining your attention to that limit. When you've got your attention onto that limit, in effect, you have thrown yourself out of heaven into hell. And you do it by identification with your physical body as central reference point to the field. Now, the whole process considered as a substance, we said was called the moon. The water aspect of it, the fluid aspect of it, as a gentleness, was called Venus. The opposite of Venus was Mars, the heat. That's fire, that's water. The opposite of the body, as such, of the moon, was the sun. So we had the planets. And the opposite of Jupiter was Saturn. So we have three planets, all bound together by the rotation of Mercury. And Mercury, we said, is the absolute, and the soul, that's absolute spirit, soul and body. The cross on the base of it means Saturn. The top part with the horns means Jupiter. And the circle in the middle means Mercury itself. So the threefold process is illustrated. The spirit is absolutely the cause. When Christ says God is spirit, he's referring to this undefinable. If he didn't define itself and make its only begotten son, then it would abide alone. It makes the macrocosmos as a seed. A funny kind of seed, because the tree of the universe grows inside it, not out. And really this cross is right in the middle, there. It's extended in this symbol and brought out so that you can see the three levels. Now the spirit is the one that gives the form and is the cause of your brain being divided. And one half of your brain has to do with the will aspect of spirit, and the other half has to do with the intellectual aspect. One half of your brain is remarkably free from patterns of activity. That's the will side. The other half is full of patterns of activity, the intellective side. In the chest here is the soul proper, which is the field consciousness, and in the belly, where you take in the food, the matter from the world, is the ground of your physical body. Now, the funny thing about it is this. The Jupiter is mentioned second after Saturn, and therefore is to be considered as a product. And the first is the world soul, which is the Christ, and that's the cosmic Christ, which drove into its own center and does so eternally, and makes exactly this process we've just discovered in order to make a universal light shine through the whole process. So this central one is the first, this one is derivative, and in the same way the brain is actually an outgrowth of chemicals in the blood centered in the heart. The heart is not merely a material thing, it also does in the field very peculiar things to the blood. So in the morphology of the human being, we find that the brain is actually a growth. It pushes up and folds itself in peculiar ways. It's a growth out of the affective life. So that all the form that is in it is really conditioned by I like it and I don't like it. There's only the two feelings, yes and no. And the brain is an outgrowth of the process in the soul. And the body is taken in from the outer world into the soul and formulated. So we have the soul dragging in from the outer world matter to make a body, and the soul, with that material gained, pushing up to make a brain with a yes-no formal record in it. So the whole process really derives from the fact that spirit has an aspect called substantial, the substantial aspect of spirit, which is the only one that we can adequately objectify, because to objectify is to circumscribe. So this is a drawing now of the macrocosmic world soul, the cosmic Christ, internal to which he produces the material world. Matter is therefore generated, and the matter, by rubbing itself, produces the heat which makes the incandescence, which makes the light of the stars and of the sun, and so on. Funnily enough, the very latest cosmological theory agrees exactly with this. Instead of having a vague process of cooling of gas, as in the nebula hypothesis, and precipitation of Earth within it, all the latest evidence says that there were material particles in the universe. They don't know how they got there. And that those material particles are driven together in a cold ball first. That's the coldness of the Saturnine compass. And then they drive upon the center to the point of generating heat. In this way, they say the Earth is not going colder, it is going hotter. That it's driving onto its center. And the prophecy which says the earth will not be drowned again, but will set on fire, is now the latest cosmological view of the scientists. The process of terrification, the production of an earth, the rubbing of those particles together to make the heat, and the continuous rubbing of them to produce the incandescence, which makes the light that shines right out throughout the universe. And that light is a substance, it's not nothing. The light is a substance in a world other than the one we see with our physical eyes. This is a light cosmic. And it condenses in particular places on the perimeter by turning round, and that makes the stars. And wherever it can, as it goes out, it turns and condenses. The condensation in our system is called the sun. And there's a continuous reciprocal feeding of the sun and the stars. The sun is a minor star. All the stars are continuously feeding each other. The body that we see in the sky that we call a star is simply a concentration point of it. And if you got near it, it would smell remarkably like a chrysalis. These three processes in the center here, of the harshness, the bitterness, and the fieriness, are the essential quality of the stars. And as they're being squeezed, they are radiating out. You can see that we can put here the 12 main groups that we see in the zodiac. And that because the whole process is a turning wheel, the qualities of compression in each part will be different. And so the whole of this space, as a universal diagram, is traversed by energies which are continuously going from one center, a star, and radiating from it with a change of phase, a frequency change, and arriving at another star, being caught in, and again radiated out. One of the problems for the astronomers was, as the sun is only a finite body, and there has been infinite time backwards, why hasn't it gone out already? The answer is that it's being fed by sidereal radiations. And the whole field of the universe is spinning all the time on two centers, echoing exactly this Saturnine compass, occurs on every point, and tries very, very hard. It tries with all it's got, and for it, it is a felt process to reach the flash point where it can then radiate through space. We know that there are new stars that have been observed. There has been no star, there has been a sudden flash. And that means that before then, there must have been a long period of inner drive of energies onto a center. Every center in a human being is exactly the same as this. It has to go through the same process. There is no other process. If we look at that, we can say to ourselves, that is a drawing of a knot hole on a tree. If you look at the way the forces have spun round to make that on a tree, and you actually, with painstaking experimental attitude, cut little pieces off it near the centre and a bit farther away and smell them very carefully, you'll find they've got a different smell, which means a different chemistry. So if you take a knot hole that big on a good old-fashioned oak or something and take little bits out of it like this and smell them, if you like, burn them, you'll find there's different chemistry there. The whole of the alchemical secrets that were put in symbols because they didn't want the church to persecute them are to do with this everlasting process. There are certain things that you can do. There are certain chemicals that will work on a person at a certain time of the year, at a certain phase of the moon, and they won't work at any other time. Certain people born in certain positions can assimilate certain chemicals, and yet those same people cannot assimilate them at another time of the year. So you see how very, very delicate it is in trying to discover a medical treatment that would be universally effective. Really, it's defeated itself. It will never come to the point where unintelligence can diagnose and then make a prognosis and then give the kind of medicine that will produce the results. Because an individual is travelling around that wheel all the time, in so doing altering its stresses and strains, and it is also driving into the centre of its own being, becoming at one point more saturnine. If you smell your palm right in the centre after a bad mood, you will smell your own saturnine compression and sour bitterness and so on in the perspiration in your palm. One of the things to do with a person that you see really annoyed, you say, do you mind if I smell your palm, please? And you will smell it. And if the person is in a very, very good mood, you will smell something totally different. In this process here, all is very, very sweet. It smells very delightful. All the beautiful smells that you get in flowers, and particularly in the petals of them, are these forces, heavenly forces, brought down nearly to the point of manifestation. Now there are certain volatile oils in the petals of flowers. They fly away immediately. If you start to heat it, they're gone. So that if you thought to get the value out of a flower for a certain process, say for a certain kind of alchemical medicine or an astrological medicine, if you were to raise the temperature of that thing too high or for too long, the effective element that you want is gone. And very often the best thing to do is just smell it, to absorb the smell. The smell acts directly on the nervous system and by resonance triggers off inside a similar kind of process. So you can actually benefit a patient physically by allowing them to smell some very nice flowers because of the effect on the nervous system. So the whole wheel then represents the macrocosmic process and the individual process. And there is no being in existence that isn't already at some level which we have represented in this diagram. So if we want to understand people and we think in terms like this and we practice looking for how much gram there is in that person at the moment, how much hot desire shooting out at the target, how much clever cunning of the mind, and rarely how much genuine love there is for us and desire to help. If we want to increase the heaven content in ourselves, it's, remember, it's a real substance. If a thing exists at all, it is a substance. This is why William Blake said time is a being. Time is not an abstract idea. Time is the whole process rotating. And that process is substantial. But substance isn't matter. Substance is that which is standing underneath all the time. That's not substance. Spirit is not substance. But standing underneath this limit, all of that is substance, but we don't call any of it matter until it breaks. Matter is defined as corpuscular. It's made of tiny little bits of atomic entities, subatomic entities. Matter is made of tiny little bits by definition. As the matura, each one is a little turn. Each electron spins on its own orbit. So we only apply matter where the thing is breaking. What it is breaking in is the field, but the field is substantial. And supersubstantially, it is spirit. We can then see how it is possible for a miracle to occur, because mercy, which we've mentioned before, as being above the will to dominate, is precisely this fluid, this oleous, heavenly warmth, which soaking in to a being releases it from the compression band of the three nails. If we can actually genuinely feel affection for somebody and let that warmth of heart flow into a person when they're being really saturnine and grabby and upset, if we can do it, then we are saving them with that feeling. But that feeling doesn't belong to the individual. There's the level of our individuality. When we are doing that, we're beyond the individual. We are non-individual. We are universal. We are sharing the mind of Christ. This whole process in absolute equilibration is called a life made of all lives. And it's only the life made of all lives, the absolute equilibration of the whole process, that is called the mind of Christ. If we can get hold of it and allow it to operate in us instead of the stimulation and toxic reactions of the physical body, then it is mercy flowing in. It actually allows that other person elbow room to do something. But it's very, very hard as long as we have a gross material body, because the gross material body is the thing that gets stimulated by other material bodies. There is a real attack to the ears and the eyes and the nose and so on our physical body, causing us continuously, if we're not on guard, to believe that an individualistic, egotistic philosophy is the truth. And if we allow that, we immediately exclude mercy. Because mercy is this absolute, substantial flow going to all beings.
Well, where does grace come in there? Is that
grace is this mercy, freely given. Grace is the freedom, non-merited.
Well, it comes from the absolute and not being from another individual. An individual can have mercy upon another individual.
Only by participating in that.
Yes.
Otherwise he has no ground of mercy.
Yes.
If he's merely an individual,
we can't talk of an individual giving grace, can we? Or is being gracious sufficient?
No,
it's in an absolute.
Yes, we have to get this concept that the individual as such hasn't got any mercy in him. Mm. He's a hellish being. The individual, ego-centered being, is simply a grab, a desire to expand his territory, and the wonderful machinery of dark cunning trying to find out how to do it. And the egoic individual has nothing else in him. So that to talk about mercy and grace is to introduce a concept that has come from outside this dark band. This is the land of Turba. Actually, inside there, and slightly to the left, there's a big wheel that twists round and gets very, very upset when an ego-centered person, or yourself during a practice when you're pretending to be egotistic, when you do that, it starts turbulating and grinding round here. And there's a real wheel going round there, the Turba wheel, and you'll feel it whenever you feel a slight loss to yourself as an egoic individual. So if you think something is yours and somebody takes it, you'll feel a little drop if you center yourself there. And most manifestly, if you do an act which you have reason to believe has caused other people to have a low opinion of you, and if you think that you will never be able to regain that opinion again, that will start going round and round and round very fast. And it can make you really ill. It causes a lot of people to get what they call a migraine. They become very, very sick, and they poison the whole blood system, and then they get a very, very bad head with it. And very often they have committed an error, and they think it's a flaw in themselves. They've let themselves down. And they think, maybe I will never be able to regain the good opinion of those external beings. And then this turbulation process goes on very, very fast. And it can produce very, very sharp pains and ribs. To realize that this process is the only process we have to study, and then to find the application of the process in individual cases, and in our own body particularly, because salvation begins like charity at home. We must start on us. To meditate on this, we use the symbols and we say, wherever there is a hard compression, there is the saturnine process. So my skull is saturnine. Wherever there is something which is just managing to exist, but is soft, Jupiter is in the ascendant. So my brain, which is mush, is under the dominion of Jupiter. My skull, which is hard, is under the dominion of Saturn. And Saturn is then my skull bone here. Exactly the same thing. That is the firmament in the midst of the waters. This is the waters Abshu. That's the waters under the firmament. This is the firmament in the midst of the waters. That firmament in the man is his skull. So we see that the head of man, as Plato saw it, is the real man. But he's an outgrowth of certain cosmic processes which are in the field of the man, which grow these things. So the Saturn hardness of the skull is there. And there is a hole inside the skull where it goes down into the body. And down there goes the spinal cord. And there we have a reversal of the process in the head. We're finding a saturnine, mercurial, Mars process. So that throughout the body we can find these manifesting in particular organs. The bladder in the body is air surrounded with a firmament. So instead of saying the bladder there is under the dominion of water, funnily enough, the alchemists said it's under the dominion of air. It is air that was generated, tried to escape, and was caught by the saturnine band, and that made the bladder. If you try to think of how to make a bladder organically, you have no alternative but to postulate the generation of a gas of some kind internally and then this film going round it. In the same way, another funny inversion is the lungs are under the dominion of the earth, although they take the air in them. Because this earth process here is continuously being precipitated within a van. So that when you see the sign of earth in an alchemical diagram in the lungs of a man, don't think, oh, that should be air, it's a mistake. It isn't. The lungs themselves are under the dominion of the earthly elements. The elements that we put into our body have a profound effect on the constitution and movement of the lungs. Let's return a moment to the practical side of this. What we want to do is secure in our own organism the end of nature, and that is this big, warm-hearted flowing that we call the heavenly state. The way to it is make yourself work very, very hard on the idea of egotism to see whether it's true. If you work very, very hard on it, you will prove to yourself that it cannot be true. And then you can let go of it. Because until you can prove to yourself that it is utterly false, you will try it out. I know a lot of men, including churchmen, who say that they believe that salvation is from Christ, and yet at the same time they believe that if they made very, very special efforts of their own, they could save themselves. Special efforts, this is the thing. Unless we are absolutely convinced of the metaphysical impossibility of saving ourselves as individuals, we will always say to ourselves, being mercurially darkly cunning, well, I haven't made a special effort yet. And so we can go on with our egotistic worldview, saying that if I make a special effort, I could strike a light. Now, in actual fact, the only way of that light infiltrating in is for us to see clearly that egotism is faulty. Faulty. It's a fall from grace. Grace is freedom. And egotism is a fall from grace. If we do not convince ourselves of the utter futility of it in gaining our absolute end, we will keep using it and trying to make better efforts next time. But if we once become convinced that it's useless, which means we've done hard work on the ground principle of egotism, actually tried it out completely, when we've seen it to be rubbish, suddenly the conceptual band of egotism falls to bits, it breaks. That's the corruption. And out of that corruption, the light comes in as grace. Now this requires terrific analytical effort to convince yourself, sitting in an armchair, that egotism won't pay. The shorter way to do it is in practice. That is to say, let me assume that egotism is a true view of the universe. And I'm an honest man. I'm not going to pretend to be anything except egotistic. I'm going to go the whole hog, proddingly. So if anybody's in my way, I shall kick them. If they're bigger than I am, I shall kick them and run. I'll have to run around the corner to go in my other way. I'll have to devise methods. And I will discover a strange thing about egotism. It doesn't take you 2 yards down the road without getting you into trouble. Now, you must try it. In your exercise on the bus, that was just a little tiny touch of not caring about somebody for a moment and taking his seat to see what would happen. Do the same thing to test egotism and see how far you can go with it. It'll take you a lot farther than you imagine because other people are terrified. Terrification is saturnine impression, falling into the middle and then breaking in bits. Most people are already disintegrating with fears. We say that neurosis is a modern disease. Schizophrenia is tremendously popular, we can call it. Falling to bits under stress. And therefore, a strong-minded egotist can go a long way. A man can be suddenly a military dictator by seizing power because other people are terrified. If they weren't terrified, he couldn't do it. But because they are terrified, 2,000 million of them, it's possible for an experimenter here and there to push egotism quite a long way before it hits back. Mussolini pushed it a long way, it hit back and dragged his body through the street. Hitler pushed it a long way. Napoleon pushed it a long way. If you haven't got the courage to push it a long way, you will not be convinced that it won't work. And if you have the courage, you'll be surprised how far it will push you. But you must push yourself to the limit, unless you have the strength of mind to sit in an armchair and work out the metaphysics to see why it cannot work. Now, the Germans have told us thinking is very difficult. It is easier to go out in the street and be deliberately egotistic, to march into a pub and say, I am an egotist, and I'm going to drink without paying, and so see what happens. You see, that is easy compared with sitting in a chair and working out the necessary logic of the financing process. Try it first. First try it in the armchair. If you succeed, well, don't bother with the other method. But if you don't succeed, then try the other method. Because you will then become convinced very, very quickly that it won't work. And then, in that conviction, the whole concept that egotism is the truth will disintegrate. Now, when the ego center disintegrates, you then go into a profound depressive cycle, which is called the dark night of the soul by the mystics. The dark night of the soul is only egotism corrupting while you watch it. My picture of myself corrupting. My favorite picture. If it doesn't corrupt, you can't get the grace. If it does corrupt, you're going to feel terrible for a time. But if you know the whole process beforehand, at the back of all the feeling miserable will be a sure conviction that this is only egotism dying, not you. This isn't the soul dying. The soul is eternal. This is only egotism dying. And so you'll find yourself smiling in the middle. Sometimes a smile will flit over your face in the middle of the most profound depression. You see, that's the soul saying, it's only ego that's dying at the moment. That little dull bloke in the middle. And if he dies, serves him right. He never was any good. And out of his matter to incandescence, he's generating that light which the soul is enjoying. So the strange fact is that a man can be smiling at certain levels of himself while he's crying his eyes out at some other level. So a person can be externally in profound misery, and you can say something to that person and a smile will flick over his face. And it will think, what am I smiling about? I've got nothing to smile about. The smile is real because it comes from a greater depth and a bigger comprehension. Whereas the misery is small, quite small. Smaller than I've drawn it on the diagram, actually. If you concentrate on your misery, you magnify it. Not spatially, but in intensity. Whereas if you remember the whole process, you will enlighten it. You'll lift it up. And the grace will come in quicker. The object of studying the whole process is to reduce the dark night of the soul in intensity to make it bearable. But you won't be able to make it so bearable that you could say, let it continue indefinitely, because you have to be driven to the term of egotism before you can let the grace in. If you stop short and say, yes, I understand the dark night of the soul, therefore I'm going to be heavenly now, you will fail. You try, in fact, say, oh, well, I'm a very, very kind-hearted, heavenly being, full of balm, herzlichkeit, loving all the universe, and you go out with just that feeling and somebody stands on your toe very heavily. And at that moment, something flashes from the center. It comes out as quick as that. And it hits back at the fact that it is not yet daylight, that you haven't really struck that light. You've just had an idea that it might be safer to see the light now. And this is where the armchair method becomes difficult. And the practical prodigality becomes relatively easy. And yet it requires a lot of courage to be a deliberate prodigal instead of just an accidental idiot. Now, is that process fairly clear now? Any points need clarification?
I would like to ask if that process is constantly going on at different levels. Each situation or problem that you transcend, you'll get another one of the same nature, and the same process will happen again. Is that so?
Yes, at higher levels.
At higher levels?
Yes. The whole process is really eternal. It appears serialized to us because we concentrate on particular zones of the universal sphere.
Now this influx of light is created by the necessity of this hellishness, is it?
That's right. That's right.
As if you've been in a situation that's driven into the stage where you felt that you completely lost the power to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you have no feeling, I would describe it as, towards the situation at all, and you're able to do it without any effort, that light has come in.
You have to be very careful about that. It is possible in certain psychological states to suddenly rationalize a failure.
I'll describe the situation. Suppose you were in a situation where you had to attempt to do something under extreme difficulties. For instance, try to do a job in the dark on the great hazards, and you were finding that that task was too much for you and you couldn't do it until you were reaching a state of collapse. And all of a sudden it all disappeared from you. You could do it with ease.
Well, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. The other thing I've just mentioned is this. A person may try to do something and realize they failed and quite suddenly make an internal decision to drop the problem completely. And then they feel very, very easy. And the next stage of that is they say, I could have done it if I had bothered. Only I lost interest. This is rationalization of a failure. The thing you describe is actually what we're talking about. That if you drive your very, very hardest into a situation, something will happen to you. This will flow in, the grace will come in.
You feel all about it. You feel all about everything that's going to happen at the time that you're doing it.
Yes. Well, that's a definite influx.
It's become a different thing from a particular problem altogether then.
Mm-hmm.
It ceased to be particular in some peculiar way, hasn't it?
Yes, it isn't particular now. A problem only exists at the particular level. At the universal level, you have transcended its particularity and it is no longer problematic. And you then know about it. There was a fellow who decided to go to America in a very small open boat. And he thought, I believe in God, why should I bother to study navigation? And why should I bother to take a compass? To be consistent, I shouldn't. So he jumped in the boat and set off. And he actually landed in America. And he had no knowledge of navigation at all. And no instruments to navigate with. But he got there, single-handed. And all he was doing when he was wondering which way to steer was just praying, shall I go this way, shall I go this way? And he eventually landed. And when he got there, he landed in rather rocky weather, and the boat was broken, whereupon the local yacht club came out and built him another. And subsequently he went off again, did the same thing, and wrecked another one. And again they built him another boat. Now, he had the courage to commit himself into a material situation with nothing to help him. And he had the consistency to say, if the God that I believe in exists, I should be all right. If he drowns me, I better drown, I may be going to heaven. But if he doesn't, it's because he wants me to get there, and I feel that I want to go. So he went, and he succeeded. He got two new boats, isn't it? Now, it requires a lot of courage to do a thing like that. To commit yourself into a material situation without any of the external defences that the egotistic tradition of society has led us to believe are necessary for our continuance. And Christ said that God knows what we need. We don't need to scramble and fight for it. He meant it. But the whole of our civilization says that we can praise the Lord, but we must keep our powder dry as well. And we can't do both. We must understand what we're doing. And if we understand the whole process, we'll understand why it is that things down there in the material world are what they are, and why identification with the physical body produces that egotism, and why that produces failure, while the failure ultimately convinces of sin, and then there is corruption of the egotistic concept with the influx of the grace. Now use the symbols to fix in your mind your own state. Watch yourself and say, am I being Saturnine at the moment? Am I being Martial? You can be anything. It is said that in the alchemical terminology, that Jupiter would become very proud if it weren't for Venus. Now Venus is the water aspect of this. The attempt to fly away as it goes away from the centre, where the sting of the Saturnine compress was, as it's flying away, the sting is getting less and less and less, and it's becoming more pleasant. So as it's approaching the perimeter of that, which has water, which is called Venus, so it's losing its interest in freedom as such, and it goes to a term where it's so easy things, oh, why bother to escape? And it's lost its concept of freedom. In the same way, a warrior, Mars, might say, I must fight for freedom, you see. And then a lady comes in called Venus and says, yes, and before you go fighting for freedom, dear, just come with me. And so he goes, and he suddenly finds he doesn't want freedom. He'd rather stay where he is for a few weeks. And the army will have to wait. So they send out a little gang of red-banded men to bring him in. Otherwise, he will stay with Venus. And this process goes through every being and every relation, every social group, every nation, and therefore you should accustom yourself to using the symbols and trying to see in every situation just what is operative.
What person that's pressed on one of those particular planetary symbols, is it his best plan to adopt in particular? That's not that symbol, I'm not
trying to find
out.
He's already...
If he's a Martian man, is it his best plan to go pushing down, fighting for a time, or...
Well, obviously he will do that, if he's so stressed. But he will not do it reflexively, consciously. No. What he wants to do is make that reflexively conscious, to see that it works. Supposing a man is born in the sign of Aries, he, therefore, is a fire man, with no desire for form, and an absolute conviction that he can do anything that he sets his mind to, if he sets his mind to it. And his ruling planet is Mars. So he's not going to alter much, unless he makes himself reflexively conscious of this bias, and says to himself consciously, I believe I'm omnipotent, therefore I must act as if I'm omnipotent. I must command and say fiat to the bus conductor, I'm not paying you today, and don't you dare report me, and so on. He must behave exactly as he feels he is, according to his stress. Only he must make it conscious. Then he'll discover that it's no use. Then he will understand the meaning of the opposite sign of the zodiac. In the same way, if you're dealing with other people, if they're stressed on any particular birth sign, your best way of dealing with them is to make them conscious of what they're doing and play the opposite to them. So if I am a Sagittarian, so if I am dealing with a Gemini type, a Gemini is a rationalist, and a rationalist is forced onto the subject predicate process. So immediately I ignore the subject and the predicate that he is talking about. The sign of Gemini is two, and I shoot between them. I say something irrelevant to what he's saying. He says that's irrelevant, and I say yes. But you see, when I shoot at something irrelevant between your two pillars, I'm not shooting at nothing. I'm shooting at something macrocosmic. Now you attend to that. Why are you bothering to try and pin me on one of your two horns? I'm shooting between them. Because he is finited by his subject predicate process. So if I'm dealing with a Gemini, I just go straight through his proposition. Shoot between his subject and his predicate. Shoot him straight in the cochlea. So you can go into another sphere. If I were a goat and I met a crab is feeling vaguely, you see, and they're very intuitive. If they become reflexively so, they make very good mediums. they're so vague that if I wanted to deal with them, I would have to say, I'm a goat. I'm born in an air sign cardinal, and therefore I demand that you deal only with a material situation. I don't want any vagaries, I want matter. Touch this chair, never mind your feelings. Feel this. Knock yourself on the scalp and restrict yourself to a material situation. Never mind your feelings. Otherwise, I will be taken off my center. And I will wallow in his level because I have no method of dealing with it. My ultimate object is to get this whole process, the life, the one life out of all lives, so that nobody can come along and say to me, you are born in a certain sign, therefore I can deal with you. Because I've swallowed all the signs. Try this on yourself. You know your own birth positions. Look at yourself and see how you're conforming to type. Think of the opposite sign and try to behave like that as an exercise. See what happens to you. See how long you can do it. But above all, become very, very conscious of the symbology that enables you to say to yourself, Jupiter, am I being too tolerant? Saturn, am I being too intolerant? Venus, am I being too soft and kind to excess? Am I being too harshly militant? Am I being radiating forces all over the place? Am I just receiving forces radiated? Or am I being remarkably mercurial? These are the test symbols.
Why is it said that Saturn will always prevail over Jupiter?
Because the world, that's this thing, is going to be eternally kept in being. And therefore, to rub it out would be to rub Saturn out and to produce valuelessness.
I make 35.
I'm not clear, I think.